Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Robert Farley, and with me today I have Paul Campos and Scott Lemieux, both of whom are front pagers that you will know and love from Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Today we are talking about the legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all of the politics and discussions that are happening associated with her passing. This includes the decision of the Senate majority to pursue confirmation hearings before the election, and it includes a discussion of the likely nominee, who will probably be the next Supreme Court justice. So, gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Very well.
I'm doing well, as can be expected.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the legacy of RBG. I want to talk both about her judicial legacy, which I think you guys are particularly qualified to discuss, but then also her political legacy, sort of what it means to have had her on the court and sort of the political fallout from the decisions that were made that were associated with the way that she left the court. So starting off on, you know, what characterized her as a justice, right? What sort of legacy does she leave behind?
Well, I guess I would say that jurisprudentially, she was a very conventional, mainstream liberal. There was nothing really radical in her judicial thought or work. She would occasionally come up with some really trenchant sorts of zingers. I'm thinking especially in the context of Shelby County and talking about, you know, you don't close your umbrella in a rainstorm because it's keeping you dry. I think that will probably be her most memorable quote. I think that my own opinion is that RBG, like her predecessor Thurgood Marshall, will ultimately be remembered more for her work as a lawyer than specifically for her work as a judge or a justice. I mean, I think she was a perfectly fine justice, but I don't think that she will be that will be the part of her legacy which will be most significant in the long run.
And I would argue, I mean, in Marshall's case, you know, that was partly just because, you know, he was never, you know, he never particularly liked being a judge. He sort of had to be the first Black Supreme Court justice, but, you know, he really liked being in courtrooms. You know, he liked telling stories. You know, he never particularly liked being a Supreme Court justice. With Ginsburg, it was more contextual. I think she liked being a justice as much as she liked being a lawyer, and she kind of had, you know, that mentality. But, you know, what they had in common was just that they were on the court during a time in which conservatives controlled it. You know, thanks to the, and we may get to this later, thanks to the successful hardball that bookends this era, the filibuster of Abe Fortas and then forcing him off the court, Justice Ginsburg wrote very few major majority opinions simply because she was rarely in the majority. And the liberals essentially had to let Anthony Kennedy take all the major gay and lesbian rights cases, even those opinions were often atrocious. But, you know, you have to, you know, the liberals were completely right to think that, you know, getting the outcome was more important than the reasoning. Her one major, landmark opinion was Virginia versus the United States. As Rob will know as well, the VMI case. But again, that happened only because there was an increasing consensus on that particular issue. And quite strikingly, William Rehnquist actually, I don't know if he joined Ginsburg's opinion, but did also vote to hold that women had to be admitted to the VMI. Scalia was the only dissenter, although Thomas would have had he participated. So, you know, that was a rare case in which sort of, you know, that Ginsburg could basically only write a majority opinion if, you know, the consensus was overwhelming, which on most cases it wasn't. But that's really not, that's not her fault. There's no flaw in her jurisprudence. And indeed, one of my big theories is that a lot of observers and scholars think about the court has been shaped by people reading The Brethren, Bob Woodward's book about the Supreme Court in the 70s, which is really interesting, gossipy book. But it was at a very atypical time in the court in which there was a very weak and widely disliked Chief Justice and a conservative court, but with a lot of really idiosyncratic voters like Powell and Potter Stewart, who could be persuaded on particular issues. And my opinion is that more people need to read Closed Chambers, which is not quite as good as a book, but is about the Supreme Court in the late 80s and early 90s. because a lot of people are, you know, obsessed with Brennan making deals and, you know, kind of, you know, getting conservatives to act strategically. Whereas Close Chambers portrays Bennett as this, you know, incredibly bitter, you know, lonely old man who the conservative chambers laugh at whenever he tries to, like, get anybody's vote. Because that's a lot more what the court is like today. And I think sometimes Breyer and Kagan sort of misunderstand that, you know, that they're convinced that, you know, that you know, all this, you know, these long game strategic things can pay off. You know, but, you know, there's really nothing Ginsburg could have done to sort of secure majorities. It's not a failing on her part. But, you know, ultimately, when she was a lawyer, she was litigating at a time in which victories were there to be had. And when she was a justice, there weren't. And that's sort of an... That was the same thing with Marshall, you know, who spent most of his life on the court watching, you know, Brown get effectively overruled and a lot of the other things he fought for get undermined. So it's quite a sad story in both cases, not really a personal failing on either's part, just a recognition that that being in the minority on a 9-person court is just not a position of very much power.
Yeah, it's definitely a structural thing. And I think that Ginsburg... legacy will be remembered as a kind of long sort of rear guard action. And it has this kind of sad quality to it, and all made all the more sad by the terrible mistake she made at the end of her career, which is going to haunt us for a long time.
Yeah, so I think that moves us along to the question of sort of what her political legacy is. And to my mind, there are two political legacies, right? One is sort of the, I would hesitate to use the word cult, but sort of the fandom that has emerged around RBG. And then the second is what's evident to us now, which was her unwillingness to step aside while there was a Democratic Congress. So how is that going to be remembered?
To make a minor point, I mean, I think that the whole notorious RBG thing, you know, there are things about it that are distasteful. I do think, however, that people are arguing that it had some kind of causal role in her staying in the court, which I very, very much doubt. You know, I think that she stayed on the court for sort of complicated reasons, but I think she was pretty clearly determined to stay on the court really before that got going. So I doubt that was the reason. And I also don't think that it was about trying to persuade Ginsburg that she was indispensable. You know, I think it was a genuine, you know, a law student read her dissent in Shelby County. You know, I don't think there was any cynicism involved. But, you know, I think that it's more of a symptom than a cause that, you know, it's sort of very hard to sort of have a position like that and not, you know, start to see yourself as being indispensable, you know, and that's sort of unfortunate. You know, and the fact is that, you know, strategic retirements are now a norm. And there's a certain irony here in that, you know, we've seen three Republicans who ended up joining the liberal faction, Stephen Souter and Blackmun, all retire strategically. And Byron White, who was a Democratic nominee, but, a quite conservative one, retires strategically. And neither of the two actual liberal Democratic nominees, Breyer and Ginsburg, retired strategically. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to discuss because, you know, I think that there really can't be any question that this was a mistake. I think people said that at the time. I don't think it's wrong to say it either. I don't think that it disrespects her very real accomplishments. I mean, I'm not, you know, I think that, you know, I don't want to, there's something to be said for not saying it in a way that, like, antagonizes people during a period of grief. I mean, I'm fine with that. But, you know, I think that it should be discussed. But it's also fair. I mean, there's an excellent piece I linked to by Rebecca Traister, you know, who kind of starts out that, you know, there's, you know, a lot of difficulty and certainly, you know, they're, you know, correct things can be still said in sexist ways and some of it is unfair, but also some of it is fair and it's complicated. But there's also a lot going on here. In that, and it should be pointed out that William Rehnquist did exactly the same thing. You know, exactly was, you know, had been addicted to painkillers for what, at least a decade, Paul, like something like that, you know, was had serious back problems, ended up getting throat cancer, but 111,000 votes go Bush's way in Ohio. And not only does that get Republicans one justice, they got two because O'Connor's retirement was delayed, during which a period of time her husband could no longer recognize her. So basically they got Roberts and Alito out of that. So there is always some bad luck. And, you know, even Scalia is a marginal case. not quite as clear cut, but, you know, he did, you know, he certainly could have, you know, resigned during Bush's second term, didn't, and he, if he passes away in 2013, we're thinking about things very differently. And I guess that's what's really painful. Sort of friend of the blog, Dorothy Fortenberry, who's a writer and producer on The Handmaid's Tale, pointed out to me recently just, you know, how there's so many contingencies here, that we were so close to having the first liberal Supreme Court majority, since 1970. If the 2004 midterms come out differently, the 80,000, we were very close to winning in 2016, despite everything, despite all the rat fucking, despite the Comey letter, despite everything, just so many contingencies. But the fact is that although a lot of things had to go wrong, starting with the various malfunctions of our counter-Georgiarian institutions, the Electoral College and the Senate, it still ultimately Ginsburg's responsibility was not to take that risk. It wasn't that it was 100% that her staying on wouldn't mean that a Democrat wouldn't appoint her successor, but ultimately, you can't take those chances. And I think Ginsburg and Breyer, absolutely should have known that. So I don't think that the criticism is unfair, even if I think we should also be careful to put that in the context of a lot of other people having to screw up for this to matter.
Yeah, I mean, just not to linger on this too much, but I do think it's worth emphasizing that the cancer that Ginsburg had in 2000, was it 8 or 9? I can't remember. When the pancreatic cancer she was diagnosed with then was very probably the most common kind of pancreatic cancer by far is an adenoma. And the 5-year survival rate for that is less than 5%. She lived as long as she did only because of her immense social privilege, led her to have an MRI every 6 months. The cancer was caught far earlier than pancreatic cancers normally are. The reason they're so deadly is because they're usually not diagnosed until quite late stage. So she had already dodged a remarkably perilous situation. And I agree with Scott very much that it's important not to emphasize this too much in the immediate aftermath of somebody's death, and especially to avoid sexist tropes. But in the end, I feel right at this particular moment, staring Amy Coney Barrett, down the barrel of that particular gun, I am feeling personally rather bitter about this. I think it was just a extremely irresponsible decision. And the whole cult of RBG stuff at this point really rubs me the wrong way, especially because although I don't think that she herself was behind that in any way, it certainly didn't hurt from a sort of propagandistic standpoint to have all of this advertising of her supposed remarkable physical vitality and advanced age being thrown out there into the media all the time. Not that I think this was like conspiratorial or anything like that, but that's just the way that it played out. I don't know. I'm right at the moment. I'm feeling quite bad about how all this has gone down.
Yeah, that was one thing that I didn't like was just the constant focus on like her workouts and her and her great physical trainer and everything, and having just lost my father to kidney cancer. Like, I can guarantee you that working out is not it's not a cure. And I don't know to what extent it's about people trying to convince themselves. And I will admit, I just sort of, I sometime during the summer, I just thought she was going to make it. There was some sort of internal clock I had that if we made it this far, it'll happen. And I think I probably just had to think that. I'll never forget. I was just, out on my walk and I had to stop to get some ice cream or something. And, in 2016, I was at a hockey game in Hartford, Connecticut. And I got a text from a friend saying, "I hope it was autoerotic asphyxiation." I'm like, "What?" And then I look at my phone and see Scalia just passed away. And that same friend sent me a one-word text saying, "Fuck." And then my wife's caller ID came up, and I knew instantly, you know, before my wife said anything, I knew exactly what had happened. And really, I've just kind of been in a bit of a fog ever since. Like, I still don't think that I've fully processed it. And it's like very much when Shelby County came down, I knew what was going to happen. I knew exactly what the case was going to be. But, you know, it was still this sort of shock that quickly sort of became, you know, and in this case, there's sort of a lower ratio of anger in it. Or anger, at least towards Ginsburg, of higher anger towards everything else. But it's still, or the election of Trump, I think, would be another comparison that I'm just not, I haven't fully come to terms with it. I'm not sure that I ever will.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny. I was just thinking about the election of Trump and as being a sort of similar shock. And it was, and for me, just idiosyncratically, the shock was similar in that it was so utterly sudden. Just because I had taken my young son to the park that night, and I had checked out, you know, the news up till about 6 or 7 o'clock Eastern time, and everything was looking, you know, like everybody had anticipated it, and I was then in a news blackout for about like 3 or 4 hours, and after I'd put my son to bed, I turn on CNN, and Donald Trump is president. It's like it just I went from like just. And I said to my wife, who hadn't been watching the TV at all, because she just hates political coverage, Donald Trump just got elected. And she was like in complete disbelief. And the first thing we did was see if our passports were up to date, which they actually weren't. So anyways, that's what the whole RBG. And I had one other thing about the RBG thing. A friend of mine who sort of knows her second or knew her second or third hand, had been telling me like 2 days earlier, oh, by the way, she's officiating a wedding on Saturday. And I was like, oh, that's so, you know, I was like, Scott, I was like, oh, awesome. We're like home free. She's officiating a wedding on Saturday. She's got to be alive for at least a couple of months after that, right?
Yeah.
And then bang.
Which also, by the way, was not really, like, as far as I can tell, there's no evidence whatsoever that she had COVID or anything, but not a great risk either. Like, you know, like that's like really tough. Like, I cannot believe that she did that.
To be honest,
like, there's just no, like, yes, I understand that, like, outdoor is relatively safe, but we're still, there's still, you know, that's just not a, you know, and again, so it's a little bit of that. Yeah, you know, and again, it's complicated. You know, she's an admirable figure, and I think one thing we should say here, I mean, the kindest I could be, and I wrote this in a piece a few years ago back when, you know, there were really intense debates and, you know, a lot of writers I really admire, like Dahlia Lithwick, were, you know, sort of taking what I think is the wrong side on this. But I will grant that a well-designed system would not put justices in this position, you know, that you can understand, if not defend, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or William Rehnquist, right? Their spouses had passed away. They probably know that if they resign, they're going to be dead in a month. They have absolutely nothing else to do. A good system would just give judges 18 years and not put them in the position of essentially having to be ends rather than means. So, you know, there is sort of a structural, you know, one of the many reasons that term limits would be better is simply that, you know, we shouldn't have justices be forced to make these decisions. You know, that there is, you know, I can understand, and especially, you know, sort of a pioneering feminist litigator who, you know, was asked by the dean of Harvard Law School to justify the position she was taking from a man. You know, I can understand a certain stubbornness on this. You know, I think that we can understand it, even if she made the wrong decision. And, you know, one of the many structural failings is simply that, you know, we should not be leaving it to individuals to make these decisions. You know, every president should get 2 nominees a term, and they should leave at regular periods. You know, because, you know, the end result of all these contingencies is going to be Republicans losing the popular vote in 7 out of 8 elections and having 6 of 9 Supreme Court slots. And that's, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, you know, failure to retire is one of those reasons. But keep in mind, even if Biden could replace her, it's still a 5-4 conservative court without a great chance of taking it back. So, you know, there's also the just the whole way in which we structure Supreme Court appointments is just a disaster. So that's the best mitigation I can come up with.
And I'm really hoping that the silver lining in how all this has gone down is that a bunch of relatively moderate centrist kind of people are maybe having, you know, their consciousness raised and their and being radicalized, at least, you know, on this particular point, because I don't see how anybody can possibly support anything resembling the present system, except from an utterly self-interested perspective, of course. So hopefully this will the impending confirmation of Barrett will push things over the line in terms of enough Democrats to say we just can't keep going on this way. This is absolutely intolerable.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and you know, you could never make this argument to a conservative audience without it coming off as, you know, advice from your mortal enemies, you know, concern troll. Like, but, you know, this is actually, you know, sort of a high reward, but also high risk moment for Republicans. You know, John Roberts is one of the few people who's, you know, Matt Damon rather than Worm in Rounders, you know, who understands that occasionally you have to fold the case hand so it's not obvious, you know, that, you know, Roberts seems to understand that, you know, that, you know, ultimately the courts don't have the power to enforce their own decisions and need to sort of, you know, make it look respectable in certain spots. And, you know, his vote is no longer necessary. You know, and so, you know, obviously, you know, it could be that Republicans are able to use the Supreme Court, stop Democrats from governing, and the nature of our institutions is simply that, you know, Democrats aren't able to effectively retaliate, but there's other ways this could have gone. You know, the fact is that, you know, had the Supreme Court knocked back down in 1937, we'd have a, you know, 15 justice Supreme Court right now. You know, that every single time in America, you know, that, and I think that, you know, and this is sort of the sort of core argument of my academic career in a sense, but, you know, strong judicial review in the United States was not established by Marbury versus Madison. It was established by, you know, Republican Congresses of the late 19th century who liked the idea of judges making public policy. You know, whenever courts have, you know, gotten involved in a real power struggle, whether that's with Jefferson during the Civil War and Reconstruction, during the New Deal, either they've been forced to back down and forced to accept retaliation by Congress, you know, one or the other. So, you know, that this idea that judicial review is just this permanently fixed in its strong form is really not true. Judicial review is held up because elites like it, and elites like it because the court hasn't stopped majority governance from governing. You know, so, you know, that if they stop that, then all bets are off. And I don't think that you're going to be able to get an expansion of the court in the abstract. Like, I don't think you're going to be able to pass that in 2021 in the first 6 months. But if the Supreme Court strikes down the Affordable Care Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2021 in June, different story.
You know. Yeah, so you're saying it's not like we won't get our hair mussed, basically, right?
Right, yeah, like, yeah.
A good part of the welfare state will be declared unconstitutional, but the upside is, you know... But you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about. I think you're quite right about that. Absolutely. That, you know, judicial review in the United States is actually a very contingent and historically tenuous kind of thing. And I was thinking about that in the context of something that I had not been aware of. Scott probably knows this, but I was shocked to discover. I should have known this. I was embarrassed that I didn't know this. But I didn't realize that both Earl Warren and William Brennan were recess appointments by Eisenhower. Did you know that? I was unaware of that. And it just showed to me, that's just such a remarkable testament to how relatively depoliticized the Supreme Court seemed at that particular moment in American history. Maybe just because after the, you know, switch in time to save nine or whatever, there was more of a sense that, well, these guys can be brought under control if necessary, so we don't have to worry about it so much or something. But obviously, we're not anywhere, you know, close to that anymore. You know, it's 1937 all over again. But I don't know whether there's an FDR around.
All right. So let's take that to leap to what is really sort of our broadly our second topic, right? Which is the hijinks of the Honorable Senator from Kentucky. I know that there was, you know, there was a lot of questions about exactly how Senator McConnell was going to approach this, whether he was going to push for a confirmation during the lame duck period and thus protecting Collins and maybe some of the other vulnerable senators, or about whether he was going to go for it. And now it really looks like he's going to go for it. So I guess, what do you guys think about sort of the way in which Mitch is approaching, you know, this particular power play?
Yeah, I mean, you know, clearly, you know, he's, you know, and again, I'm not, if I were him, I would also probably be taking these risks. So, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, he's wrong to do it. He's clearly gone maximalist. And I think, you know, Paul's last comment reminds me, there's a really good article written by Mark Graber called The Coming Supreme Court Yo-Yo. And the basic point of the article is that, the one reason that the Supreme Court confirmation process didn't blow up, and really the advised consent structure is just a terrible, terrible constitutional design. Like, a well-designed constitution would either let the president pick executive or judicial branch appointments, or maybe, like, you know, two-thirds of the Senate can override it, like a veto, you know, something that, you know, requires that there be actual bipartisan consensus. But of course, the framers were in denial about political parties. But it's kind of miraculous that it didn't blow up until now. But Graber's point is that for much of American history, ordinary voters were more polarized than party elites. You know, that fundamentally, the difference between Eisenhower's Justice Department and FDR's Justice Department was not actually that great. You know, like Robert Jackson and Herbert Brownell, Jackson wasn't super liberal, and Eisenhower's guys weren't particularly conservative. So, that Eisenhower's DOJ would just, you know, when Eisenhower said, "Get me a Catholic judge," you know, they can look at Brennan and think, fine. So I think that the difference now is that partisan elites are much more polarized than ordinary voters. And that just means that, you know, there's no, even if it were desirable to have a country club Republican median vote, they don't exist, so that there's just no way that the Supreme Court isn't going to lurch between an Alito-like Republican or a Ginsburg-like liberal. And under those circumstances, Supreme Court nominations become such a high stake that, you know, basically you're not going to be able to get a Supreme Court nominee confirmed by an opposition Senate again. Like, I 100% believe that we would have a seven-person court right now if Clinton had won but Republicans held the Senate. And McConnell's actions just reflect that. You know, it's in an era of high polarization, it encourages maximization.
Yeah, no question. I agree 100% that that's what would have happened. And should Biden win, but the Democrats not take the Senate, which doesn't seem like a likely outcome now, but, you know, could happen. I don't expect that any Supreme Court nominations that come up will be filled until the Democrats actually have the Senate. And I think it's a completely untenable situation going forward. And it is going to be something that will be very corrosive in regard to public confidence in all of the institutions that are involved. And here I'll mention one thing which I think is relevant to some of RBG's what seem in retrospect perhaps rather idiosyncratic tolerance for things like Bush versus Gore. I mean, obviously she was dissenting, but she just didn't seem to be nearly as outraged by some of the Republican, maximalism as a lot of.
Well, can I add to that one? The most striking thing is that she had a footnote in her dissent, basically saying that, you know, the real violation of equal protection was, you know, Jeb Bush disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of black voters. And Scalia basically wrote a memo saying, you know, I know I'm not always a shrinking violet, but, you know, take this and literally this Al Sharpton rhetoric out of your opinion. And Ginsburg went along, which I actually find quite shocking. So again, it's like not only to be bullied by Scalia of all people, sort of nastiest, you know, rhetoric on the court, but like that's actually an extremely important point that needed to be made. And she just lets, you know, Scalia bully her out of that, which I do think reflects that's her sort of there's a certain sort of belief in civility and institutionalism and sort of not understanding that ship had sailed, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes to a point that you were making earlier about the relative lack of bitter division among the elites in the earlier generation. You know, in the late 50s, early 60s, when Scalia and Ginsburg were both at Harvard as law students initially, and then as they began their legal careers, along with the other, Supreme Court justices from that era, I just think that they were just deeply imprinted with some kind of very elite sort of clubbable conceptualization of who they were and what it meant to be running these institutions that's just completely disjunctive with current politics. And I don't want to oversell that. I mean, I think people can definitely change over time, but nevertheless, I think that the people who grew up with a sort of legal process vision of, like, you know, Albert Sachs and Henry Hart and all the people who were, like, talking about how law was essentially a kind of rational consensus-driven activity, those people have been running things for so long that they never really caught up with the changes that were taking place. You know, that basically the Republican Party was losing its mind over the course of several decades and has ended up, you know, on the edge of full-blown fascism. I think that a lot of people of that generation have never really caught up with that. And it remains to be seen the extent to which Joe Biden has caught up with it. You know, I mean, I certainly hope that he has. I mean, he's a little bit younger than that generation. He's, you know, 10 years younger, I think, than 9 years younger than RBG. But, you know, that's, I guess what I'm trying to express here is I think part of what we're seeing now is a kind of generational shock where a bunch of people have never really been able to accept what has been going on. And for them, Donald Trump is just this bolt out of the blue. You know, they're kind of like these stupid French aristocrats in 1780 who were like, how could this have possibly have happened? Well, it's like, yeah, you know, if you've been paying attention, it's actually not that surprising. So, you know, Mitch McConnell, sort of the prince of darkness of, you know, all of this stuff, understands perfectly well that we're in a completely maximalist situation. And to answer Rob's question, you know, his options were either ramming something through before the election, which, you know, clearly had some downsides, but which was a much less risky strategy than sitting there and taking the enormous political hit that they would surely take if they ran the nomination through in a lame duck session. So I don't think there was any question that he was always going to put this through before the election was to take place. It was simply too big of a gamble not to do so.
Yeah, especially if Kelly were to win in Arizona and get seated immediately, which would give them less margin. Another point I want to add to Paul's point is that in addition to liberals sort of not, you know, coming to terms with what the sort of new Republican justices are like, is, you know, that, you know, liberals have always had this kind of, you know, stop hitting yourself mentality. Leah Littman, a law professor at Paul's alma mater, had one of the few commencement speeches I ever heard that was worth hearing, in part because it was basically a long subtweet of Herb Wexler and the other, you know, liberal academics of the 50s who were just, you know, thought that the Warren Corps was very disturbing and they couldn't quite justify it. I don't know how, you know, I mean, you know, how can you adjudicate between African-Americans wanting civil rights and segregationists wanting the right to associate by, you know, it's just, you know, and of course, Charles Black had one of the greatest law review articles ever in which he points out, you know, saying that segregationists consist with equal protection laws is just literally laughable, like just a literally farcical proposition. And yet, you know, tons of elite legal academics wrote about Brown as if it was the hardest case in the world and basically just in, you know, it's just, it's unbelievable. You know, particularly when you look back, and especially the Warren Court of the 50s was not particularly liberal at all. And even the sort of actual liberal court of the 60s, you know, really, you know, that its decisions were much less radical. That, you know, if you think about Miranda, you know, Miranda was not, you know, confessions are not an acceptable part of the system. Here's a roadmap to how you get confessions. And yet, you know, the sort of not only did those decisions produce an hysteric reaction from reactionaries, they produced so much consternation among a lot of liberal legal academics, which is just totally different from how movement conservatives are just, you know, able to adopt the most, you know, ludicrous arguments. And just, you know, what did you see Mitch McConnell today saying that, you know, how could you possibly think that Barrett will vote to take away people's health care? She has a special needs child. It's like literally McConnell saying, if you have my position on health care, you hate children. Like, that's literally like, you know, like did Nino Scalia hate his 9 kids? But it just shows you that, like, they sort of know their positions are both, like, immoral and completely legally unjustifiable, so much so that they have to deny that their nominees actually hold them during the time of confirmation hearings.
Well, that's the thing is that it's, I mean, again, it goes back to that thing that became evident when opinion group voters just couldn't believe that, you know, Paul Ryan's positions were the positions that the Republican caucus was taking. They thought this was completely insane. I mean, could you imagine if any American, like, median voter understood what, say, Randy Barnett wants to do with the Constitution and with the federal judicial system? I mean, there would be like a complete riot. These people want to basically go back to the 18th century. And the only reason they're not doing it is for purely prudential reasons, because to go back to Scott's point about the nature of judicial review, they can't get away with it. But if they could get away with it, they'd do it in a New York minute. We're not just talking about the New Deal. We're basically talking about anything that happened after, like, you know, 1787, pretty much.
Yeah, and Barrett literally has a fawning review of Barnett's last book.
Right. I mean, this is just, and of course, as is always the case, the very, very worst slander that can ever be made against any Republican is to simply state their views to them, especially if you do it in their own words. That's their definition of slander, to quote them.
Yeah, that's Borking. I mean, like, literally what Kennedy did was to just state Robert Bork's publicly, like, he wrote a New Republic piece saying that the Civil Rights Act was based on a principle of unsurpassed ugliness. Like,
that's right. You know, it's like, how dare you say he opposed the Civil Rights Act, and then you have to do, like, narrator voice, he opposed the Civil Rights Act.
Exactly. You know? No, it's
and so let's talk a little bit about Barrett, you know, because we haven't really talked much about her. What about her? What does she represent? To me, she represents the ultimate triumph of the Federalist Society's, like, long-term project. And I think there's some basis for thinking that the reason she didn't get the nod the last time, you know, when they put Kavanaugh through instead, was they specifically wanted her to replace Ginsburg. And, you know, she's like the epitome of this phony right-wing narrative about, see, all the sort of woke talk about sexism and all that stuff in America is just complete nonsense, because here's this woman with 34 children and, you know, adopting, like, all these refugees from Haiti and everything else, but she can be on the Supreme Court, and if you oppose her, you're a sexist and you're an anti-Catholic and so on and so forth. I think that's ultimately what she represents. She's the ultimate fuck you, essentially, to the liberal left in this country. And I just want to say one other thing, because something Scott was saying really reminded me that I wanted to get this out there. Try to imagine for a moment if we had a Supreme Court that was left in the same sense that the Supreme Court has been right over the right wing over the last, you know, couple, three decades. In other words, well, I think what Scott was referencing in regard to the Warren Court is we've never had anything even vaguely resembling a left Supreme Court in the United States, right? I mean, just the most sort of moderate liberal DNC Supreme Court is considered, of course, by right wingers to be just, you know, essentially something Maoist. But if we were to have a court that did anything even vaguely left, like suggest, for example, that there might be some kind of right to, like, minimal public support so as not to starve to death in the United States, there would just be an explosion, you know, because we are so used in this country to having the worst sort of right-wing extremism rammed down our throats that even the very idea of a left-wing judicial opinion is something that is, like, apparently stuck somewhere in, like, Duncan Kennedy's notebooks or something, but can never actually happen in the U.S. reports.
Yeah, like, imagine, like, Mark Tushnet being, who's, yeah, sort of moderate of the years anyway, but just, like, a matter, like, Kimberly Crenshaw being the median vote on the Supreme Court is inconceivable, but that's the right. I mean, there's no right equivalent of Crenshaw because she's actually a good scholar, but, you know, it's just that it's just, you can't even imagine five, you know, like, critical race theorists, you know, taking over the Supreme Court, whereas, like, the most hardcore reactionaries being a median vote is just not even an issue. And you're also right that one thing
that's actually literally the situation. If Mark Tushnet was John Roberts, that would be the reverse situation.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's and another thing, and you're also 100% right to point out that just this the farce this makes out of, you know, complaints about identity politics, you know, they're literally dressed up the Rose Garden exactly as it was for Ginsburg's nomination. It's just, you know, and this goes by. It's exactly the replay of what happened in 1991. when, you know, Marshall was forced to resign, you know, and was extremely sick, and Bush was at 70% of the polls, which another historical counterfactual, you know, and had the recession happened a year earlier, he might have hung on, but, you know, again, nothing breaks right. But, you know, but Marshall said when he was resigning, you know, my father always said, you know, there's no difference between a white snake and a black snake. They both bite. You know, knowing exactly who is going to be nominated to replace him, you know, and it's the same thing. So, there's no question that it was always going to be a woman who replaced Ginsburg, and it was just going to be the cynical with it. And again, the attempt to gin up, you know, we wrote about it on the blog, but it's just amazing that, you know, just en masse, Republicans said, you know, Democrats are going to focus on, you know, Coney Barrett's faith. And their one example was a column written by Liz Bruning. And it was a column that was not particularly anti-Barrett. Plus, Bruning is a traditional Catholic, and Bruning's political identity is built around despising the Democratic Party. But, you know, other than that, very robust evidence.
Liz Bruning, I think Liz Bruning might actually be up for a cabinet appointment in the Biden administration. She's like a really central person to like the Democratic establishment right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
perfect. God, I hate these people so much.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry, Rob. You can edit that out if
you want to. No, it's all good. I'm happy leaving that in.
Yeah, so, you know, that's, you know, but ultimately, and just, you know, that I do think the Democrats seem to be handling this right, which is, you know, first of all, you can't, you know, stop this nomination. And secondly, you know, just don't take the bait about her as a person. You'll start off with some boilerplate about how I'm sure she's as, you know, fine a wife and mama as she can be. And then just, you know, just like she wants to, you know, she's written that Sebelius was wrong, you know, like that's, you know, the, you know, and again, let Mitch McConnell cry about it all he wants. But like this idea that, you know, the Trump administration is saying that the Affordable Care Act should be struck down, you know, based on this idea that, you know, if you amend one part of a bill, then you're clearly meaning to repeal it all. I mean, just literally to state this argument is to.
Right. Like, no, it's a rule 12B5 nomination to like make this like it's a completely frivolous argument on its face. And what the Democrats should absolutely do is say nothing but. Amy Coney Barrett wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act through judicial legislation, by legislating from the bench. The Republicans are legislating from the bench. They are taking away health care from tens of millions of Americans because they don't like a perfectly constitutional bill. That's what they should just say over and over again, and they shouldn't talk about anything else, in my view. You know, they should just hammer home that message over and over again. I would have Harris just handle the whole thing and just, you know, unfortunately, I don't think they'll do that, but they should just hammer that message home with extreme clarity over and over again, because that is a killer argument from a political standpoint, not to mention it's actually legally correct.
Right. They said it would be particularly helpful if they took Dianne Feinstein into like a room that locks on the inside and forget to give her the keys for 3 days.
Yeah, right. Speaking of another person who's like, you know, I mean, I know I sometimes come across as like kind of like, you know, a little bit ageist and stuff. But I mean, come on, we can't have 87-year-olds running these things. You know, it's like having a 48-year-old like point guard in the NBA or something, you know, it just doesn't work. You know, we've got to have
It just take some responsibility, you know, and I also think about, you know, what this would have looked like had both Biden and Bernie not run. But having said that, let me give one silver lining about Joe Biden, whom I think it's safe to say that if there was a 10 slot ranked choice ballot, none of us would have had Biden on their list. Is that safe to say? But let me say one good thing about Joe Biden, and this is one reason I underestimated him. He is one thing he's done very well that Clinton did not is to link negative personal attacks on Trump to policy. You know, if I had any objection to, you know, the Clinton campaign is that, you know, Trump basically, you know, could be read as being a moderate if you ignored some of what he said. But, you know, really, they didn't do as, or I should say, she did a pretty good job of highlighting that in speeches and during debates. But like their advertising was just all just, you know, personal character stuff. Whereas, you know, Biden has really been singularly focused on, you know, healthcare, which worked really well in the midterms. And I think this is an opportunity. And that's why they need to turn these nomination hearings into the Republicans don't have the votes to take away your health care, they're going to have the Supreme Court do it. And the audience for this is not just the public for the election, but it's Democratic members of Congress. You know, that one implication of this should be, you know, let John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh know that if and I think Roberts already understands this, that if the ACA is struck down, that's the best way of making it likely that Congress rains fiery hell on the Supreme Court. You know, that it doesn't have to be explicit, but that should be the implicit message that this is, you know, that that it ain't going to be over. You know, that, you know, you strike down the, you know, like, you know, convince Brett Kavanaugh to pretend he actually cares about severability or something and like fight another battle.
Right.
You know, then, so that's another reason to do it.
And then expand the court anyway, just like
pour encourager les autres.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, and that's, I think, one thing, and another thing about this is that, again, I don't see court expansioning happening right away, but I think one thing this does is make, you know, say, statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico a lot more likely. And that's actually quite important for these battles in that, you know, a more fair Senate would make it harder for Republicans to take it over during the midterms. Because I think one difficult thing we have here is that there's a potential time lag, which is that, you know, the war on the 20th century regulatory state may not be joined in earnest until 20, you know, by the time, you know, Roberts will slow walk all the controversial cases. And so, you know, and, you know, if all these decisions come down when Republicans have taken back the House or Senate, you know, there's really nothing you can do to retaliate. Whereas, you know, you strike down the Affordable Care Act when Democrats have a trifecta, you're both risking a, that Congress could do something about healthcare, but they could also do something at the court. The Senate map is already pretty favorable in 2022. Adding two states makes it more likely you hold the Senate. And it even, you know, frankly, every House seat counts too. That's often been forgotten, that, you know, that adding states also means, you know, that increases your margin in the House, makes it harder to gerrymander away. So I would hope that, I think that there needs to be a focus on, frankly, I don't even think statehood is constitutional hardball. We've done it 37 times. I don't understand, and actually, like, the burden of proof should be on people who think that, you know, people should be taxed without representation. So I even reject the idea that it's constitutional hardball. They should be made states because it's the right thing to do. But again, it's a bit of Herb Wester, right? That Democrats almost feel apologetic about doing something that is right on the merits because it helps them. whereas Republicans have no problem, stopping black people from voting if it helps them. It's just like this real asymmetry. So like Democrats have an advantage that doing the right thing democratically also helps them, and they need to do that. That if they don't have the votes to expand the court immediately, they do need to expand the Senate immediately. They need to pass robust voting rights legislation and dare the Roberts Court to strike it down. Things like that. And I do think that this nomination, the midnight confirmation will make that more likely. In particular, I do get the impression that especially younger Democratic senators are just going to tell McConnell to piss up a rope when when button norms start up in January of 2021. That's going to be a pretty hard sell right now.
I think that's all right. I mean, I agree with all of that. I do think that the big question is, assuming a Democratic trifecta here, and one that is a comfortable one, in the sense that maybe, the Democrats have 53 Senate.
Yeah. Every vote really matters.
So that you're not depending, on, Manchin to necessarily go along with everything or what have you. Assuming all that, what do the Republicans ultimately do? Do the Republican elites in particular? I mean, the sort of conventional standard move would be to say, oh, well, Donald Trump really doesn't represent us in a lot of ways. And yes, he was really excessive, but we're all reasonable men here. And this is super radical, what you people are recommending. And we can't do this kind of thing because of comity and blah, 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 blah. Can they do that when the Trump base is going to be just in a complete frenzy about having lost? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that they can. In which case, you're going to get this kind of hyper-partisan showdown in regard to all these issues, including court expansion in particular, which of course will just be seen by these people in their utterly irrational, delusional way as some kind of horribly anti-democratic sort of maneuver. So, I mean, I to me, that's the real sort of unanswered question of the moment.
And one thing that I think is too, you know, I'm actually, and I may be proven wrong, you know, perhaps optimism about anything is misplaced, but I'm actually relatively optimistic that the filibuster will be eliminated. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that McConnell was not a total obstructionist, or at least wasn't a totally successful obstructionist. You know, that part of the reason that the legislative filibuster survived 2010 was that Democrats were able to get the ACA passed during the 60-vote window, and then were able to get AARRA and the Ledbetter Act and Dodd-Frank. You know, they were able to get just enough Republican votes to get that over the line. You know, that had McConnell really been able to obstruct anything, that would have been a different issue. You know, and they did obstruct the circuit courts and took that gamble, and finally the, you know, even Pat Leahy, you know, had enough. You know, so I think that, you know, it should be pretty obvious that, you know, that the total obstruction is coming this time. You know, there's no way. And that's where, like, starting off with voting rights is a really good one, that even if they should eliminate the filibuster right away. But if, you know, there'd be no better way of going nuclear than the John Lewis Voting Rights Act of 2021. You know, let Republicans try to claim that, you know, a civil majority shouldn't be able to pass a bill protecting voting rights. You know, and I think another thing people have to understand is that, like, Joe Manchin, in a 50-vote, you know, when a majority can pass anything, is one of the most powerful people in America. You know, it's not like legislation is going to pass that moderate Democrats don't like. Like, they still have close to a veto. But if there's a 60-vote supermajority, Manchin's exactly as powerful as Elizabeth Warren, which is to say, not at all. Right. And that's different. You know, back in the old days, the filibuster was very empowering for the center of the Senate. That's no longer the case. And Manchin isn't dumb and also isn't running again, probably. So I suspect that he may very well understand that. So, you know, I, you know, again, maybe I'm, you know, again, optimism is probably going to be punished during this period. But, and that really is the whole ball game. You know, if they can't get the filibuster abolished, we can all just go home.
Right. But, I mean, I would have one caveat here, which is that Biden remains a wild card on this. You know, I understand that he, you know, even if he's in favor of abolishing the filibuster at this point, he wouldn't say that just prudentially. But, you know, prior to the last, you know, few months, I would have said he was absolutely the worst Democratic candidate in regard to this particular issue. So hopefully, you know, he's had a conversion experience. I think there's a reasonable chance of that, but it's not something we can just assume. We just have to keep our fingers.
Although crossed. We also don't need Biden to do this. That's, you know, it's like he doesn't have to sign legislation, you know, like that's just, it's internal Senate rules, right? So they
that's
can, you know,
true. We don't need him to, but we do, but we
his
do.
Support need, would be helpful though.
Support would be very helpful, you know, in terms of it's, I mean, to put it this way, if he openly opposes it, I think it would be extremely difficult for the Senate to do. So,
yeah. Yeah, we need him not to oppose it. And again, it's also, and there's a way in which, you know, that it could go both ways, that Biden, you know, can be institutionalist and Harris can't take him out of it and he can sabotage this. But on the other hand, if he understands the filibuster has to go, he has a certain credibility in saying, you know, look, nobody is more committed to, you know, civility, blah, 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 than me. But, you know, this new Republican Party, even I can't work with it, you know, so. So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, again, I really wish we were not taking these high risk gambles. There are a lot of better choices. But, you know, but having said that, there's a lot of, I mean, Bernie Sanders is very, you know, institutionally conservative, but I'm pretty confident he's not going to stand in the way of this. You know, so everybody's opposed to these changes until they aren't. So, you know, I hope that, you know, again, if we get Pat Leahy on board for the nuclear option, I'm hoping that, you know, and somebody just has to, like, Harris has to talk to Biden and say, like, you know, if you want to be a one-term president who doesn't pass literally any legislation, then oppose filibuster reform, you know, but like, you know, otherwise you really need to do this. And I'm hoping that he has the air. And that's where I think Harris having served in this version of the Senate, I think will be quite helpful for that.
Yeah. She understands what's going on. Well, yeah. This has been really great. I have to run. So thanks to all of you and both of you. And that was a lot of fun.
Just to sort of close things out. And thanks very much, Paul. I do want to say that we should at least be a little bit hesitant when we're talking about D.C. and Puerto Rico. I think D.C. will be an easy climb on that. Puerto Rico will be a much harder climb.
It should be clear that should be an option to the territory.
The opinion in Puerto Rico is not united around statehood.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, I should say that the D.C. should be granted statehood and Puerto Rico should be given the option of statehood, but it should be up to the voters of the territory, and of the Virgin Islands, et cetera, et cetera.
So I want to thank both of you for joining us. I want to thank all of our listeners. And please join us again for the next time that we have a podcast with these kinds of subjects. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.